Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters Today. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, from WILL AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. It is a lovely, wonderful late winter day, regrettably in late April, but lovely nonetheless. Today we're going to have a terrific show. We've got a guest coming to you from Canada, one of the great young journalists of our generation. Someone who's writing up-to-the-minute stuff on Iraq and what's going on around the world, regrettably too little of which has found its way into our mainstream press, but will find its way into your hearts and minds today. So please join me today for Media Matters with our guest Naomi Klein. But first, let's go to Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
New developments on the Paola punditry beat. A report released by the Department of Education says the agency did not get its $250,000 worth of positive publicity from conservative commentator Armstrong Williams when it hired him to promote the No Child Left Behind program. But the report does not give the full story. Although members of the president's staff were involved in the Williams case, the White House refused to let Education Department investigators question them for this report. Meanwhile, as government-produced video news releases continue to circulate, the FCC steps in to assert jurisdiction over their use. In an April 13th notice, the agency reminded TV stations that if they use VNRs, they must clearly identify them and, quote, "We will take appropriate enforcement action against entities that do not comply with these rules," end quote. The prevalence of public relations material in local TV news is surprisingly large. A survey of local TV news directors on their use of video news releases found nearly 60% say they've used VNRs, but only 10% clearly identified them for what they were. Today, less than half the news material on local television is produced locally. Now there's news of companies paying for product placement in contexts that resemble interviews. The Wall Street Journal just published a multi-part investigative report on the practice of magazine editors, especially those working for technology or consumer products-focused publications, renting themselves out for TV product endorsements. Such punditry has been used to plug products by Apple, Energizer, HP, Kodak, Mattel, Microsoft, Radio Shack, Sony, and Walmart, among many others, on local and national morning TV news talk programs like Good Morning America and The Today Show. Companies pay between $12,000 and $15,000 per plug. Both ABC and NBC deny knowing that these particular pundits were being paid, although NBC counts one of them as a member of The Today Show staff.
Even though he pioneered the daytime TV talk show format, it's been 2 years since Phil Donahue's been on air on a regular basis. He spent close to 30 years in syndication before taking a break. A comeback stint on MSNBC was cut short in 2003 because he opposed the U.S. invasion of Iraq and allowed anti-war guests to speak their minds, even though Donahue was MSNBC's highest-rated program. Donahue's now engaged in the movement for media reform, and he wishes the format he pioneered would help lead the way. His syndicated program was popular for the forum it gave to the members of his studio audience, a component of the program Donahue says he initially overlooked.
After about four or five shows, I realized that during the commercials, they were asking better questions than the host. So it wasn't some genius vision that moved us. You know, I just one day jumped out of the chair and ran out in the audience. Clearly, we never would have become the Donahue Show syndicated nationally without the audience.
In today's world of TV talk, the audience has been effectively marginalized in exchange for what public relations professionals call message consistency. Because his MSNBC program did not fit that mold, Donahue says the show was never really secure in its time slot. He thinks that's a shame, because there's no better time for healthy debate than in a time of war. And a lack of debate promotes dangerous thought conformity.
That is the reality of millions and millions of Americans today. Shut up and sing. It's amazing. We've sent millions of young men and women to war, many of whom have died on foreign battlefields, to preserve and protect our way of life. At the center of that way of life is the right to dissent. If we don't use it, we're wasting their courage and their blood and their pain.
Phil Donahue will be one of the featured speakers at a conference on media consolidation and its effects on democratic discourse. The conference takes place May 10th and 11th on the campus of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign and is free and open to everyone.
And now, here's a Media Minute's Fast Fact. According to a major study from Columbia University's Project for Excellence in Journalism, opinion permeates today's news. And nowhere is this more prevalent than on Fox News. Of all the news coverage Fox gave the war and occupation of Iraq last year, nearly three-quarters of it included the personal opinions of Fox anchors and reporters. This is compared to just 2% of CNN reports that contained opinions from the same period, although CNN is the least transparent about the sources it uses for stories. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie dokie. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, April 24th, I think it is. Yeah, my producer gives me the thumbs up there. 2005. Today we've got a great show for you, a show that I know that a lot of our listeners have been waiting for. We've been anticipating having this guest, and we finally have her on board. Our guest this week, Naomi Klein, the Canadian-born journalist and author of the international bestseller, No Logo, Taking Aim at the Brand Bullies, which the New York Times called a movement Bible, a book that has earned her justifiable acclaim around the world. More recently, since that book has come out, she has become an international journalist covering Latin America, covering Iraq, and covering what's going on in the world in a manner that regrettably too few journalists are doing, at least the journalists that we're exposed to in the U.S. news media. It is my pleasure to welcome Naomi Klein to Media Matters. Naomi?
Hi, Bob.
Hey, great. Thank you so much for taking time out of your schedule to join us, because I know you are, if I'm not mistaken, working on a book right now.
I am, yeah.
And the book is, I think, what we're going to talk a lot about today. Tell us a little bit about the book.
Well, the book, it sort of emerged out of research I did in Iraq a year ago about the economic side of the war, about the neocons' plans to turn Iraq into a free market utopia. And when I was in Iraq, what I was really researching was the connection between shock, like a severe shock to the system. And in Iraq, it had a name, which was shock and awe, as large a shock as one can imagine. The connection between that kind of shock and the imposition of what economists call shock therapy, which is very rapid and kind of brutal economic transformation. And the third element that I was researching was the connection between another kind of shock, which is torture, which is looking at the role that torture plays to enforce social control when people are rejecting both occupation and economic shock therapy. So that's what the book's about, but it's not just looking at this formula in Iraq. It's looking at how shock is used as a political tool in the United States with the shock of September 11th and rapid economic and social change, and even the rise of torture by U.S. use of justification of torture by U.S. officials and around the world. So that's what it's about.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Iraq. Since you've spent time there, you've written about it quite a bit over the past couple of years, what's going on there. You know, it seems from my perspective, reading the U.S. News media as I do, watching U.S. television news, that there are sort of two sort of themes that go on in our news coverage. One is sort of fairly often there'll be coverage, especially in the print media, of just what a nightmare situation Iraq is on the ground for the whole U.S. occupation in terms of the claims that it would be wonderful and welcome and successful, punctuated every now and then by enormous bursts of stories about some turn of events that now proves the war was a success and things are going better, starting back from the toppling of the Saddam Hussein statue 2.5 years ago or 2 years ago to the, mission accomplished on the boat, to the capture of Saddam mm-hmm. Hussein, to Jessica Lynch, and most recently, the elections, mm-hmm. Which are held up then almost uncritically as, wow, finally some good news, and, mm-hmm. and we've turned the corner. And then now we're back again at the bad news, sort of taking over the euphoria of the free election of late January.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you can, from your experience, I mean, what is an accurate picture of what this occupation has gone like, and what's actually taking place,
mm-hmm.
Well, as opposed to what we're getting?
Well, first of all, I think, you know, in talking about I think as you rightly describe, you have these hyper-managed media moments, which are, you know, much less about journalism than they are about really expert public relations, really managed moments like the fall of the statue, or the marketing of the elections, complete with a sort of logo, the purple fingers, and a ready-made slogan, you know, purple power, and a new narrative, the idea that these elections were spreading democracy through the region, and just repeated over and over again against tremendous, you know, in the face of tremendous logical flaws in the argument, you know, that the elections in occupied Palestine were the result of Arafat's death. And in fact, it happened previously in 96, you know, that there wasn't a causality between anything going on in Iraq and Palestine, and indeed in Lebanon, that the protests were triggered by Hariri's death, not anything going on in Iraq. That said, I think that the elections were tremendously significant for Iraqis as an expression of a very deep desire for democracy and for an end to occupation. So I think that, you know, we need to be able to talk about, at once, the media spectacle of the elections, the U.S. media spectacle of the elections, the way they were manipulated to serve the interests of the Bush administration, and all while at the same time respecting the fact that Iraqis did indeed, at tremendous risk, express what I saw very clearly when I was there, which was a real desire for the freedom that they were promised, and a tremendous anger that it was not being delivered. And I think that continues to this day, where there's a tremendous amount of anger that what people voted for, which was an end to occupation, is in no way being respected, that they are locked within a U.S.-designed political process, which has drastically augmented the power of the U.S.-friendly Kurds while shutting out Sunnis and diminishing the power of the Shia majority. And that's why it took so very long to form a government, and why they seem to be kind of in a permanent state of deadlock, leading potentially towards partition if things don't improve quickly. So we have these things going on simultaneously. In terms of how the war is going, I think it could scarcely be going worse. And I think that the extent to which these public relations exercises are effective corresponds directly to the lack of journalistic freedom in Iraq. And by freedom, I guess I mean both kinds of freedom. I mean there are real restrictions on journalism in Iraq. You have Al Jazeera being banned, you have Al Arabiya being politically interfered with, you have publications being shut down, but then you also just have the practical fact that journalists are largely locked in their hotels and don't have mobility because journalists have become targets. And so, in a way, the propaganda machine is effective precisely because it's going so badly that real journalism is impossible, if you see what I mean.
No, in fact, you might have seen this story, an editor and publisher in the last issue, Naomi Klein, but a number of U.S. correspondents in Baghdad flew back to the National Conference of the ASNE, the American Society of Newspaper Editors, last week. And they basically were caught with that. Said, look, we're locked into the green zone. We can't even go outside for longer than 20 minutes mm-hmm. without fear of our lives. And that's a maximum period we can ever go out of our armed room. And this is coming from the leading correspondents of the Washington Post, the Dallas Morning News. I mean, right on down the line. This is understood.
So occasionally, I mean, there was a piece in the New York Times about 4 days ago, a very, very good piece of journalism about the on-the-ground effect of a little bureaucratic decision that was made, I guess it was made almost a year ago, which was to transfer $2.5 billion that was supposed to be going towards water projects, water and sanitation, of the $18.4 billion that was allocated by Congress for Iraq's reconstruction. They took 2.4 and moved it over to from water to security. So this was a follow-up story about a water treatment facility that was in the middle of being reconstructed, and they had to just stop work, and they said that this had happened in 19 water projects, I believe was the number, where progress was happening and they were getting the water. They were improving the most pressing humanitarian issue in Iraq, which is access to uncontaminated water. And they just had to stop work because all the money had been gone to protecting the American occupation from the Iraqis they're supposedly liberating, okay? And the only reason this story was written is because it was in Iraqi Kurdistan, mm-hmm. where there is a measure of mobility. So journalists are able to go and talk to Iraqis with some freedom and you know, do real interviews. In Baghdad, that becomes virtually impossible. So you have all these stories which simply take the word of, you know, if you contrast that, for instance, with a recent, I think quite scandalous, LA Times article by T. Christian Miller about the fact that Bechtel claims that it rebuilt 19 water plants, but they're all already broken because Iraqis are so lazy and incompetent that they can't run them. Now, I read this article, and there wasn't a quote from any Iraqis. It was all official sources.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't even believe that Bechtel actually had rebuilt all those water plants. I'm not going to take their word for it. I mean, their record of incompetence is just absolutely mind-boggling. So here you know, that's just one, you know, two different kinds of stories. One is a story which is on the ground talking to somebody who's been rebuilding the water plant saying we were abandoned so that they could spend money on security. And another one is just, you know, a green zone story, which is the word of Bechtel, the word of military officials, blaming Iraqis for the fact that they can't run their own reconstructed water plants. And so that's the type of story that we're getting, reliant on official sources. And I guess all of this, the extent of the lack of mobility, the extent of what journalists, I guess, are the context, we saw with the case of Giuliana Screna, the Italian mm-hmm. Italian journalist. Who,
yeah, you wrote about that. Would you, Naomi Klein, would you give our listeners a little bit of background on that, please?
Yeah. I think that people probably remember the very dramatic story, although it, you know, disappeared in Shaivo land shortly thereafter. But
yeah.
This is an Italian journalist, an incredibly committed and I think quite heroic war correspondent for an Italian newspaper called Il Manifesto, which is describes itself as a communist newspaper. It's basically a left-wing daily newspaper in Italy, quite a good one. She's Giuliana Screna has been covering the war in Iraq since the start, and has, you know, been going to the region for many years. Has been to Iraq, I think, 6 or 7 times. And she decided to go back after the second siege of Fallujah in order to interview Fallujans who had lost their homes in the conflict. You know, and she really deliberated about whether to go back, because this was after the other Italians, Simona Pari and Simona Toretta, had been kidnapped, after Margaret Hassan, a humanitarian aid worker, had been killed. But Giuliana Screna is so committed to the idea of telling the stories of regular Iraqis, of refusing the role of the embedded journalists, of relying on official sources, that she went back despite this danger. When she was doing her work, she was kidnapped by a wing of the resistance. She was held for 1 month. She was released by a very senior Italian Secret Service agent named Nicola Calipari. And immediately upon her release, I have this information directly from Giuliana, who I met with in her hospital room in Rome, and also have spoken to her on the phone several times since. Calipari and another agent, Italian agent, drove her to the green zone. They had security clearance, and then they drove on a special diplomatic road to the airport, not the main road that is extremely dangerous, but a totally secured road only for top diplomatic vehicles. And she was fired on by a U.S. vehicle that was parked on the side of the road, an armored vehicle, a Humvee, opened fire on their car, and Calipari was killed trying to protect her. He was fired on from the right, and then the U.S. troops continued to fire on their car, and Juliana was shot in the back and injured quite badly. So, in her story, you really see what life is like, not just for journalists, but for regular Iraqis, caught in this pincer of this incredibly lethal, reckless occupation, where just driving down the road can get you killed, and the resistance, which is also lethal.
We're talking to Naomi Klein today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580 in Urbana, Illinois. We do have phone lines open if folks would like to call in. The number is 333-9455, and our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Naomi Klein is a world-renowned and award-winning journalist and author, author of the book No Logo, Taking Aim at the Brand Bullies, currently working on a book on what's going on in Iraq, which we've been talking about, and I think also broader issues that grow out of this with global implications and strong critique of U.S. politics. Naomi Klein is also the author of a terrific new article in The Nation magazine, the latest issue, the May 2nd issue, called The Rise of Disaster Capitalism, which I want to talk about later in the show. And then finally, Naomi, while we're on the subject of your resume, you and Avi Lewis have a film, The Take, which you made that came out last year, which received considerable acclaim and very high praise from reviewers, which is a documentary over your experience in Argentina a couple of years ago. That film will actually be showing in Champaign-Urbana tomorrow night, coincidentally.
No kidding.
For free and open to the public, Monday, April 25th, tomorrow night, 7 p.m. in the main lounge of Allen Hall. You can go see a film that was described as a stirring, idealistic documentary by the New York Times, or better yet, from Toronto's Globe and Mail, a thriller, hard, sharp, and provocative. Naomi Klein and Avi Lewis's film, The Take, 87 minutes long, which has won considerable acclaim. I'd urge folks to go see it. I plan to be there. It is supposed to be a terrific film. I've heard nothing but good things about it.
Well, it's about another, I sort of feel like the last few years I've just been immersed in different kinds of occupations. The occupation of Iraq, obviously, but the film, The Take, is about a completely other kind of occupation, which is workers occupying their factories that were closed down because of global forces, because after Argentina's economic collapse, there was this huge flight of capital, and all of these communities were turned into ghost towns, and the machines and the factories were being auctioned off, and in 200 factories, workers decided to take over their plants and make them work again. So that's a happy kind of occupation. We think that the film, we say, is one of the only documentaries with a happy ending. That's all I'll say.
Well, I'd like to talk about it a little bit more, but let's go back to Iraq and finish up some of the points we were getting at there. I mean, the important issue, I think, that we're being told in the United States now by the government is that, forget weapons of mass destruction, forget, 9/11. I mean, that wasn't the Iraq war, wasn't about that. We now concede those were lies. Instead, this war is about spreading democracy to the Middle East, especially Iraq, but really the whole region, and a U.S. Wilsonian effort to bring peace, freedom, liberties to this region. And it seems like there's a real problem that you've gotten at there. On one hand, by all accounts, the majority of Iraqis in their who they voted for on election day voted for candidates or parties that were for near-term or immediate exit from Iraq and the United States. Yet, on the other hand, the evidence that I've been seeing, what you've been talking about, suggests the United States has no plans to leave whatsoever. And it seems like if there's a commitment, or in the near future at least, if there's a commitment to democracy, something's got to give. Either they're going to accede to the wishes of the Iraqi people, or they're not really serious about democracy. What's up?
Well, Bob, they're not really serious about democracy.
Okay. I guess that's a rhetorical question, Naomi.
Yeah.
But, I mean, you've written about in detail what's going on. And what are the aims, then, from your...
Well, I think that they are... maybe it's just that we have different definitions of democracy than they do. I think that they are interested in sort of show elections. They're interested in the sort of ritual of democracy. And I think that originally... The occupation was based on an ideological belief that free markets and free people go hand in hand. I mean, coming out of a sort of Cold War end of history ideology, which the Wolfowitzes and the architects of this war, you know, that is their gospel, and it's in, you know, it's embedded in the national security strategy of the United States that free markets are not just a part of democracy, but are a moral right. And that was their vision for Iraq, that they would go in, they would, yes, they would have elections, and obviously the Iraqi people would choose to first of all, the order that they did it in was they radically restructured Iraq's economy and made it the most open market in the world. It went from being the most closed market under economic sanctions, sealed off, to the world's most open market, where you could have 100% foreign ownership, or Paul Bremer announced he was going to sell off 200 of Iraq's state-owned firms. And what was interesting about this process was that here they were making these fundamental decisions, fundamentally political decisions about what kind of country this was going to be. Was it going to have a public or a private healthcare system? Was the oil going to be public or private? I mean, these are the issues that animate any democracy. But they were being treated as technicalities. Like, of course Iraqis wouldn't be involved in these decisions because there was really no decision to make. That was the mentality of the neocons. They denied that they were even making what were deeply political decisions by treating them as technocratic decisions, because in their mind, because they're so ideological, that there was no there is no other way to run a country, right? So they did this. I call it the extreme country makeover Iraq edition, right? I mean, where the idea is, you know, that the Iraqis were just supposed to, like, look at their brand new restructured country rebuilt by Halliburton and Bechtel, and just gasp with, you know, pleasant surprise, like the contestant on a reality television show. And it didn't go that way, because it became clear very, very quickly that Iraqis had their own ideas about how to run their country that were based on the most powerful ideas in the region, which are economic nationalism, which are, you know, control over resources, using the wealth, the oil wealth of the country, to have a more autonomous economy. These are ideas that are, you know, deeply embedded in the sort of psyche of the country. And so what I think a real turning point was when the International Republican Institute, which is the sort of international wing of the Republican Party, conducted a poll a few months into the occupation, where they asked Iraqis if they would, which type of candidate they would likely vote for, if they had elections, which they were supposed to have, you know, fairly soon after the invasion, one of the questions was, would you vote for a political party promising to create jobs in the public sector? And half of the respondents said yes. And they said, would you vote for a political party promising to create jobs in the private sector? And only 4.5% of respondents said yes. In other words, they weren't buying this sort of corporate utopia, the idea that you know, Paul Bremer fired 500,000 people as his first act in office, and that they were all going to get wonderful private sector jobs. People weren't buying it. Mm-hmm. And so at that point, what happened was, is it became clear that the vision, the free market vision for Iraq, was in direct conflict with the free people vision for Iraq. In other words, that these two ideas, that these ideologues believed, are inextricably linked. That free people, that a radical free market and a liberal democracy are necessarily go hand in hand, came into direct conflict. And the supposedly free people of Iraq made it abundantly clear that if they had elections, they would vote for a very different kind of country. And that's when democracy really became the enemy of the occupation, and they went to tremendous lengths to suppress anything that I would consider to be genuine democracy. So that's when you started to see real attacks on journalistic freedom, and it's also when you started, when they moved to the idea of an appointed interim government and started to lock in all of these economic changes through deals made under occupation or under an appointed U.S. government, under an appointed Iraqi government appointed by the U.S., deals with the International Monetary Fund, deals with the World Bank, that lock in all of these reforms well into the future, so that by the time Iraqis get to vote, it is this ritual. It is this, you know, hold up your purple fingers. And we heard this in American media analysis about the elections that it didn't matter who Iraqis voted for. What it mattered that they voted. We heard this again and again, that it was the fact that they took tremendous risks to vote that was the real significance. But once again, if you asked Iraqis, and there was a poll that was conducted, you know, what was the most significant aspect of the elections, they said that the most significant aspect of the elections was that they voted out the U.S.-appointed interim government. And they said that that was more significant than the fact that they were free of Saddam Hussein. And when they asked, you know, was the fact that you stood up to terrorism and voted important, it was something completely insignificant in terms of who said that that was important. What was important was what they voted for. I mean, and we've seen this incredible attempt in the U.S. media coverage to belittle this and treat elections. You know, Hunter S. Thompson, shortly before his death, said that for Republicans considered democracy to be a tribal ritual, and I think we saw that very graphically in the coverage of those elections.
We're talking to Naomi Klein today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Naomi Klein is the award-winning journalist, author of a couple of books, No Logo, Taking Aim at the Brand Bullies, as well as Fences and Windows, Dispatches from the Front Lines of the Globalization Debate. We're talking a lot about her work on Iraq and the sort of global disaster capitalist industry that is at work in Iraq and around the world, sort of recreating it in a certain way without a great deal of public participation or at least involvement in making the core decisions. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment for Naomi Klein, the number here is 333-9455, the toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. The lines are open. I have a caller patiently waiting I'll get to in a second. But before we do get to the calls, let me point out that Naomi Klein will be right here in beautiful Champaign-Urbana in just a few weeks as part of the Conference on Media Consolidation and Freedom of the Press, Tuesday, May 10th and Wednesday, May 11th. She'll be speaking twice during those 2 days. If you'd like to learn more about this conference, we now have a website you can go to make it handy, dandy, and easy. www.iimpr.org, imper.org. We've got the schedule there. This is free and open to the public. People there, besides Naomi Klein, include Amy Goodman, Seymour Hersh, Don Henley, John Nichols, and a cast of thousands. It's a terrific group of people. I urge you all in the community to get out and to tell your friends about it since it is free and open to the public. Again, our guest today, Naomi Klein. Let's go back to the phone lines. Line one, you're on the air with Naomi Klein.
Hi, let me welcome you in advance, and I'm so glad the film will be screening. I would like for you to talk about how you see Iraq as sort of structural adjustment as by, you know, at the point of a gun, as, and how you would integrate that, you know, overall neoliberal policy with, you know, what's being done in other parts of the world, like in Venezuela, well, attempted in Venezuela, but more in the Argentine, and that sort of thing. And then also, what do you make of Wolfowitz going to the World Bank? Because a lot of people are saying he's sort of put into exile. A lot of people make personal allegations about it, which I won't go into. But it seems to me that besides doing things like making sure World Bank loans don't go to Iran, which they did a couple of years ago, and other parts of U.S. policy, that he could be quite dangerous there just in being a structural adjustment enforcer. I mean, we've had these pretty much unreported stories here in this country of the U.S. going along with negotiations about intellectual property vis-a-vis pharmaceuticals and then throwing up the, you know, the table at the very end of the negotiations, which Cheney did personally about AIDS drugs to Africa. So it just seems to me that I don't think he's in exile. I think he's in the center of the game still in a pretty nefarious way. So I'd like for you to comment on those sorts of things and appreciate your coming to town. Thank you. Thanks. Bob.
Sure thing.
Thank you. And I'm really looking forward to coming to town. I think it's going to be a great conference and hope to meet lots of you in person then. I agree completely with your analysis of the significance of the Wolfowitz appointment to the World Bank. And I actually get very frustrated when I hear people talking about this as him being put out to pasture, because I think it speaks, frankly, to a kind of American arrogance and parochialism in just not understanding how incredibly powerful the World Bank is around the world.
And if I can just interrupt for 1 second, Naomi, your piece in The Nation, the May 2nd Nation, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism, I think, does a nice job of just pointing out how central the World Bank is in this whole process you're describing. So being the head of the World Bank is hardly a ceremonial or inconsequential position.
It's a tremendously important one, and one that could very well outlive the Republicans in office. You can get your World Bank once you're in there. If you want to stay in there, it's actually hard to get rid of you. He could be in this post for 10 years, potentially even longer, which means that you might be able to get rid of the Bush. We will get rid of the Bush administration, but you might be able to get rid of Republicans in the White House. But Wolfowitz will stay on, and I think we're seeing this embedding of certain key neocon architects into the apparatus of these international institutions in a few different ways. We'll see how Bolton's appointment goes. Mm-hmm. But in terms of the connection, the connection between neoliberalism in Latin America, caller mentioned Venezuela. And what's going on in Iraq, I think the connections are very, very deep in the sense that these economic policies that were imposed in Iraq with tremendous violence, with the shock therapy through shock and awe, are the reason why policies like this. I want to say explicitly what the policies are. They are mass privatization of basic services. They are huge layoffs in the public sector, removal of price controls, so basic food items are very expensive, as well as gasoline in Iraq. The reason why it's called shock therapy is because it's not fun. it's because people don't consent to it. The theory behind shock therapy, which you hear from everyone, from Jeffrey Sachs, who imposed it in Bolivia and in the former Soviet Union, to the architects of privatization like Yegor Gaidar in Russia, is people will oppose these policies if they're given a chance. Nobody who imposes these policies pretends they're a Democrat. Argentina's former president, Carlos Menem, described the imposition of these policies as surgery without anesthetic and said, if I had told people what I was going to do when I was running for office, they never would have elected me. Okay? Mm-hmm. The idea is that these policies are so painful. Of course, these ideologues believe, it's short-term pain for long-term gain, but they're so painful that the idea is you want to impose them very, very quickly so that people can't respond because they're facing so much dislocation. And you want to do it immediately after a major cataclysmic event in a country, like a war or the collapse of a regime in the former Soviet Union, or even after a major natural disaster like a tsunami or a hurricane. Because the idea, the friend of these policies of shock therapy is dislocation, is shock, having people in a state where they can't respond. I mean, I remember debating this on CNN, CNN International, not in the U.S., but immediately after the invasion in Iraq. I had wrote an article calling the reconstruction of Iraq privatization in disguise, and I had a debate with someone from the Weekly Standard who said, told me very condescendingly, Iraqis don't care about the privatization of their water system. They just care about getting some water, right? I mean, it's immediately after a war. And, of course, that was exactly true. You can't care about the privatization of your water system if you're worried about just getting some water and shelter and finding out whether your family members are alive. And that's precisely why these moments of extreme dislocation are used to impose shock therapy. That was the case in Latin America. That was certainly the case in Argentina and Chile, where this formula was really pioneered. The phrase shock treatment was first used in Chile after Pinochet's coup by the so-called Chicago Boys, who went in immediately after the shock of the coup and imposed these very unpopular policies. In Iraq, though, I think we are seeing a new level of violence and a new level of force that is actually related to the fact that these policies are being rejected in many parts of the world where there is a level of freedom and there is a level of I don't know if I would call it peace, but certainly more peace than there is.
Well, there's some stability, so it's not like the country's falling apart.
Yeah, and I was in Argentina making the film, making the take when the war in Iraq began, And I was learning this history of how the economic policies, these same economic policies of privatization and deregulation, what we call globalization, were imposed in Argentina through tremendous violence, through the military coup in 1976, and a regime of torture and disappearances, and then were continued under democracy until the whole system collapsed in 2001. When I arrived in Argentina, the country, and indeed the continent, was in revolt against these economic policies that had been imposed through violence, but now that people had a measure of freedom, they were throwing out neoliberal presidents right, left, and center. I mean, we saw it in Brazil. Most recently, we're seeing it in Ecuador with Gutierrez. We've seen it in Bolivia. Certainly, we see it with the support for Chavez in Venezuela. Now we're seeing it in Mexico with the tremendous controversies right now, where you have a system where they're trying to prevent a left-wing mayor from running for president because they know he'll win. So the continent, where these policies were really designed and this economic model were really designed, now that there is a measure of democracy, is rejecting them en masse. And I did have this feeling when the war in Iraq began that because of the inability to impose these policies without war, they are now being imposed with tremendous violence and force in another part of the world, that there was a connection in some way between the failure and the rejection of neoliberalism in Latin America and the sort of upgrading from sort of free trade light to free trade heavy or free trade supercharged in Iraq.
Is this what you're going to be writing about in your new book, Naomi?
Maybe a little bit, yeah.
It's such an important point. I'd urge you to like get at it a little bit, because I think it's one of the most striking observations on the relationship of neoliberalism and militarism.
Well, they are related, and I guess my goal in doing this writing and this research is to show that the work that we were doing in the movement against corporate globalization is not passé and is not no longer relevant. And that was one of the things that we heard immediately after September 11th. Everything you knew before is wrong. Now it's just about clashes of civilization. And there's this narrative of exceptionalism around the Middle East that, scholars like Rashid Khalidi are very articulate in debunking, saying this whole idea of uniqueness, of sort of pathologizing the Arab world, the so-called Arab world, and treating it as completely different as every other part of the world, is really part of the problem, and that we need to remember our global analysis and our economic analysis in order to understand what's going on in this region.
We're talking to Naomi Klein today in Media Matters. We're coming to you live from WILL AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Naomi Klein will be in town, as we said, May 10th and 11th for the Conference on Media Consolidation and Freedom of the Press. Information on that can be found at www.iimprimper.org. Also, Naomi Klein and Avi Lewis have a film, The Take, a documentary on their experience in Argentina a couple of years ago. It will be showing tomorrow for free in the main lounge of Allen Hall at 7 p.m. at 1005 West Gregory. And this movie has gotten phenomenal reviews from the New York Times, the Globe and Mail. Our own Roger Ebert gave it a glowing review. I don't know if you saw that, Naomi.
It was kind of freaky, yeah.
Yeah.
It wasn't exactly a rave review. It was more like he was suddenly questioning the basic underlying principles of capitalism.
Yeah, no, it was
him a bit of a crisis.
He's a hometown boy, and he just had a big film festival here, so everyone around town knows about him. If you'd like to call in with a question for Naomi Klein, we do have lines open, and I promise to get to all the callers. 333-9455 is our local line. Toll free 1-800-222-9455. And I'm going to go to the phone lines right now. Line one, thank you for waiting. You're on the air with Naomi Klein. Hello?
Yes,
that's you.
Naomi, thank you for taking my call. Do you think that Paul Wolfowitz has a personal agenda for humiliating Islam? And with that, I'll hang up.
All right. Well, thank you, caller.
A personal agenda for humiliating Islam. I don't claim to know, to be able to look into the minds of these men, or at least not all of them. Couple of them I have some insight into. I don't think that that is what's driving him, no. I really believe that it is an ideological belief that essentially you know, the debates I have with myself about this is, you know, how much can we attribute to ideology and how much can we attribute to just blind greed? Because in the case of these guys, you know, there is this revolving door between the consulting company, their own consulting companies like Kissinger and Associates, or Halliburton, or the list goes on, Carlyle Group, and the ideology. I think sometimes we can treat them, we can give them too much intellectual credit in the sense of believing that they are genuinely driven by belief as opposed to by greed. In this case, however, I think that their ideology so neatly serves to justify the greed that one doesn't even really have to choose. So I do believe that those are the major forces at work here, as well as obviously he's a very staunch Zionist, and that is part of the picture in Iraq of this idea of creating friendly neighbors for Israel. I think that I would say that that's more the goal than humiliating Islam. That said, the effect of his policies is one of is profoundly humiliating, and also the fact of their policies is so reliant on ignorance and racism, Islamophobia, if you prefer that phrase, everything from the use of religion against prisoners in Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib, and the reliance on a non-Muslim Americans seeing themselves as so different from Muslims that they can learn about what's going on in Guantanamo Bay, learn about what's going on in Abu Ghraib, and still feel themselves to be safe as if it has nothing to do with them, because the people who are being racially profiled, under surveillance, being sent into these dark holes with no legal recourse, are so other and different from real Americans, I say in quotes, that they will not respond. So if you see what I'm saying, this whole system is completely reliant on the, you know, I don't want to sound academic because I'm not an academic, but, you know, on the treatment of Muslims as other, on the perception of Muslims as entirely other, that they will be able to get away with and have been able and are actively getting away with war crimes, and including torture.
Yeah, you make a pretty convincing case, Naomi Klein, that the U.S. aims for Iraq, as for other places in the world, but specifically Iraq, are to have sort of a privatized U.S. Dominant economy, where mm-hmm. U.S. firms operate and make money and direct a so-called free market economy. How important is having permanent military bases in Iraq to sort of U.S. plans in your thinking? I mean, is this as important, or do they have a vision where actually U.S. troops and bases will be gone when the coast clears, so to speak?
Oh, no, they want the bases. I think that the main goals are having a major military, ongoing, permanent military presence in Iraq, which is not to say a permanent occupation of Iraq in its mm-hmm. current form. No, I don't think they want that.
Yeah,
I think they want enduring bases.
Yeah. We have bases in South Korea and Germany, and we certainly don't occupy those countries.
Right, but I think that they want Iraq to be a major site for what they're calling enduring military bases, mm-hmm. and they also want not just for Iraq to be a fully open market to U.S. companies, but the theory is that Iraq is the sort of the thin, like we'll crack open the whole region, that it'll have a domino effect. And George Bush, 5 days after he announced mission accomplished, announced that he wanted to create a free trade zone for the entire region in the next 10 years. So it's not a secret, and it's not a conspiracy. This is the next big free trade project after the free trade area of the Americas in Latin America. And this is because this is really the last frontier of free trade. Oil wealth has kept the region relatively protected from neoliberalism. Even the so-called, you know, even friendly countries to the U.S., like Saudi Arabia and Kuwait, are very centralized, controlled economies where a great deal of the economy is nationally controlled, not open to U.S. investors, and they don't much like that. So I think it is military bases and free trade, and Israel is a factor. But what's clear is in all of the polling and in how Iraqis voted in the election is that all of these goals are not compatible with democracy in Iraq. That Iraqis don't want this radical free market vision for their country, and they also don't want the military bases, and also have very strong views about Israel that are in no way coincide with Paul Wolfowitz's.
We're talking to Naomi Klein today on Media Matters. We've only got about 7 or 8 minutes left. If you'd like to call in, phone lines are open. Naomi Klein will be in town, as we said, May 10th and 11th for the Conference on Media Consolidation and Freedom of the Press. I hope you'll be able to join us. And her film that she did with Avi Lewis, The Take, is showing tomorrow night, Monday, April 10th. April 25th, excuse me, 7 p.m. in the main lounge of Allen Hall, 7 p.m. Allen Hall is at 1005 West Gregory. I urge you all to go see that film if you have an opportunity. Naomi Klein, the other issue that strikes me as very interesting is this whole question of how many Iraqi civilians have died as a result of the liberation occupation war in Iraq in the past 2 years. And this is an issue that, you know, in our U.S. news media has been very difficult to get at, despite what would seem to be the centrality of it. Here we are liberating people. How many of them have paid the price, the ultimate price for their freedom?
Mm-hmm.
What's going on there? Do you have any sense of what the legitimate casualty figure is, and why aren't we learning anything about this?
Well, we're not learning anything about it because there's been an active policy from the start not to, you know, we don't do body counts, is what General Tommy Frank said, and that policy that was said about Afghanistan, it was applied in Iraq as well. And anyone who tried to do body counts, people working for Iraq's Ministry of Health, for instance, were actively shut down. I mean, they were told not to collect these figures. So there are two sources. There's the website Iraq Body Count that relies on news accounts and mm-hmm. figures from hospitals to try to get some picture of casualty figures. But as the occupation becomes more and more deadly, I think that those figures become less reliable, because I think that when you had more mobility for journalists, where people really were covering every attack, every explosion, we were really able to get some kind of reliable number.
Mm-hmm.
But now there are 50 to 60 attacks a day, according to the Defense Department, and only a fraction of them are being covered. And we are relying almost exclusively on military figures, which are in no way reliable, I mean, in terms of who is
sure.
a civilian and who isn't. So then we have the Lancet study that came out, I believe it came out in October,
mm-hmm.
That was a study of what they described as excess deaths. And they put the figure at 100,000 since the invasion. That was before the siege on Fallujah. So obviously, the second siege on Fallujah, which was very brutal. So obviously, there have been many, many more since then. But I think the real issue is that this should be a demand of the anti-war movement in the United States. We shouldn't accept the idea that we don't keep we don't do body counts, we don't keep civilian casualty figures. We should be demanding it, and the media should be demanding it,
mm-hmm.
and it isn't happening.
Naomi Klein, I wish we had a two-hour show today, not that I want to hog your time, but we have a full bank of callers, belatedly, with only a few minutes left, and I'll try to get to many of them as possible.
Okay.
I turn to the callers, let me remind listeners that next week we do have a two-hour show. John Nichols will be our guest. We'll be on from noon until 2. We'll start an hour earlier. Please tune in. It's going to be a terrific show. But now let's go back to the phone lines. Line 1, Urbana, if you could make it short and sweet, you'd be a hero.
Okay. Just a comment on my concern, not only in the increasing consolidation of the media, but also increasing consolidation of the banking industry.
Okay.
Huh?
Naomi, is that something you've, in your work on disaster capitalism, does the banking industry play a role?
It's not an area that I've done particular research on. I certainly share the concern. It's a key piece of the puzzle. It gives these banks a tremendous amount of power. I saw this sort of firsthand in Argentina, where they had completely deregulated the banking sector so that it was all, you know, CIBC and HSBC and Barclays that controlled Argentina's economy. And as soon as things started to go south, they took $40 billion out of the country in cash in the dead of night in Brinks trucks and took them to American Airlines flights and flew it out of the country, and that is what crashed the economy.
Let's go back to the phone lines. Line 2, Chicago, you're on the air with Naomi Klein.
Hello, thanks for your work. I appreciate it very much. Quick question is, the people in the United States, do you have any insights as to why those who are so upset by people coming into this country for work, when maybe it's the result of NAFTA and so forth, and they see our own railroads and schools and so forth falling apart and local governments running deficits, why we are so willing to support military presence in so many other countries and the contractors over there taking the jobs of Iraqis and others who want to work to rebuild their own country, and U.S. people are working over there instead of helping us here.
Well, thank you, Naomi.
Yeah, this is a great point, and it is true that, you know, this country is not known internationally for its consistency. You watch Lou Dobbs on CNN night after night just railing against the foreign workers coming in to do jobs that most Americans don't want to do, making this country work, and there's absolutely no discussion of really the most inflammatory aspect of the occupation, which this caller just put her finger on, which is Iraqis watching their jobs that they believe are theirs, the engineering jobs, construction jobs, rebuilding their country, going to not just Americans, contractors, but also what's happening is that Bechtel and Halliburton give the top-level jobs to Americans, but then they ship in low-wage employees from Southeast Asia to do the more menial work because they're afraid of Iraqis. And it's this fact, more than any other, that led the reconstruction to be seen not as a process of national healing, not as a kind of a new deal for Iraq, but really as an extension of the foreign invasion, which is why the reconstruction itself became a target for the resistance.
Let's go to our last caller, line 4, Indiana. You're on the air with Naomi Klein.
Yeah, thanks a lot. Speculation, how you think this whole thing is going to turn out in whatever time span you want to go with.
That's a great question to end on. Yeah, how can the neoconservative Wolfowitz, Bush, Cheney dream, can they win in Iraq, or is it hopeless?
Well, I think they've already lost. They've already lost. And the question is the country going to be allowed to descend into utter chaos, and it's pretty damn close right now, to me, I'm very bad at predictions, I have to say, but one thing I think is worth asking ourselves is what sort of pressure can be applied in the United States for there to be an ending that actually could in some sense be positive. You started off the show, Bob, talking about all the lies behind the war, the weapons of mass destruction and the Al-Qaeda link, and ending up with this latest lie, which is that Iraq was invaded to bring democracy. One thing about this lie is that it's a useful lie in the sense that the approach among Iraqis to this particular lie has been to try to hold the Bush administration to it. I mean, mm-hmm. They know it's a lie. They know they were invaded for their oil, and they know they were invaded for military bases and, you know, for interests in Israel. But they're still determined to hold their occupiers to this promise of democracy and freedom. And I think that the anti-war movement and the opponents of the Bush administration in the U.S. would do well to learn from that example.
Naomi Klein,
hold them to it.
I hear the band tuning up. On that note, I've got to thank you so much for joining us today here in Media Matters.
It was a real pleasure. Thank
and
you.
We'll see you in a couple of weeks at the conference. Folks, I'll see you in 166 hours with John Nichols. Have a good week.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance, private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events, lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
In Champaign-Urbana, weather today, partly sunny skies and breezy conditions, high of 54 degrees, northwest winds 20 to 25 miles per hour. Partly cloudy early in the evening, then clearing tonight, low of 35 degrees, west winds 10 to 15. Tomorrow, look for partly sunny skies, high of 63 degrees, west winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. And tomorrow night, mostly cloudy with a 50% chance of rain showers, low of 42 degrees, south winds 10 to 15. This is WILL Urbana.